government in new and complex ways in order to decide on an appropriate response. It was an epochal moment in the history of life. It marked the birth of the brain. Brains. Basically, there are two types of animals, says Colombian neuroscientist Rodolfo R. Llinas. Animals and animals that have no brains. They are called plants. They don't need a nervous system because they don't move actively. They don't pull up their roots and run in a forest fire. Anything that moves actively requires a nervous system. Otherwise, it would come to a quick death. A neuron is often likened to a logic gate of a computer. A logic gate, built from transistors, can be wired together with other logic gates to create a circuit that, for instance, adds together two numbers. But whereas a logic gate has only two electrical inputs and spits out a signal that depends on the current flowing in those two inputs, a neuron can have 10,000 or more dendritic inputs and spit out a signal that depends on the complex interplay of all those electrical inputs on numerous neurotransmitters and receptors at the nerve cell's synapse. So, although it is true that a neuron is the fundamental building block of a biological computer, just as a logic gate is the basic building block of a silicon computer, it is more than this. A neuron is a computer in its own right. Brains, built of neurons, are expensive to run. The human brain accounts for a mere 2-3% of the mass of an adult, yet guzzles about a fifth of the body's energy when resting. Having said this, the brain does all of its mega-computation on roughly 20 watts of power, the equivalent of a very dim light bulb. By comparison, a supercomputer capable of an analogous rate of computation requires 200,000 watts. It is 10,000 times less energy efficient than the brain. For some creatures, however, the energy expense of running a brain is simply too great. The juvenile sea squirt has a rudimentary nervous system that enables it to wander through the sea searching for a suitable rock or hunk of coral to cling to and to make its home. When it finds its spot and takes root, it doesn't need its brain anymore, says American cognitive scientist Daniel Dennett. So it eats it. Despite this rather disturbing example of auto-cannibalism, the benefits of having even a simple brain usually appear to outweigh the costs. For instance, the nematode worm, Caenorhabditis elegans, has a brain with a mere 302 neurons, so few that its brain is completely encoded in its DNA. The nematode worm, unlike the sea squirt, does not eat its brain. It must therefore provide the worm with an important competitive advantage. The human brain weighs about 3 pounds and has about 100 billion neurons. By sheer coincidence, roughly the same number of stars in our galaxy, galaxies in our universe, and people who have ever lived. The human brain is the most complex object known in the universe, says Edward O. Wilson. Known, that is, to itself. According to a theory developed by American neuroscientist Paul MacLean, in the course of evolution, three distinct brains have emerged, accreting one on the other. With modern parts atop old ones, the brain is like an iPod built around an 8-track cassette player, says American journalist Sharon Begley. The oldest and most primitive part of our 3-pound universe includes the brainstem and the cerebellum, which turn out to be the main structures in the brain of a reptile. Our reptilian brain controls vital automatic functions such as body temperature, breathing, heart rate, and balance. Wrapped around the reptilian brain is a structure that developed in the first mammals about 200 million years ago. The main parts of this limbic system are the hippocampus, amygdala, and hypothalamus. They record memories of good and bad experiences and so are responsible for emotions. Wrapped around the limbic brain is the largest structure of all, which first became important in primates. This cerebrum, or neocortex, can overrule the knee-jerk responses of the more primitive parts of the brain. It is responsible for language, abstract thought, imagination, and consciousness. It has an almost boundless ability to learn new things, and it is the seat of our personality. In short, the neocortex is what makes us human. Actually, there is one more layer wrapped around the reptilian brain, limbic system and neocortex, and that is, of course, the hard bony shell of the skull. Because important things go in a case. You got a plastic sleeve for your comb, a wallet for your money, and a skull for your brain, observed George Costanza in Seinfeld. The skull is actually reinforced by three layers of protective tissue known as the meninges, in between which is a special shockproof liquid known as cerebrovascular fluid. An infection here causes the potentially fatal inflammation known as meningitis. The neocortex is divided into two hemispheres, connected by a bundle of nerve fibers called the corpus callosum. In effect, therefore, we have two brains. Usually, the left side is better at problem-solving, maths, and writing, while the right side is creative and better at art or music. For reasons that are not completely understood, the left side of the brain controls the movement of the right side of the body, and vice versa. This is why people who suffer a stroke in the left side of their brain lose movement on the right side of their body, and vice versa. A stroke is usually caused by a blood clot in the brain that blocks the local blood supply, damaging or destroying nearby brain tissue. But the wonder of the brain is not in its gross structure, but in its microstructure. In its 100 billion or so neurons and 1,000 billion other support cells which surround the neurons and their axons, providing them with energy and generally keeping them healthy. However, the sheer number of neurons reveals little about the operation of the brain. The liver probably contains 100 million cells, says American neuroscientist Gerald D. Fishbach. But 1,000 livers do not add up to a rich inner life. The key to the brain's amazing capabilities are the connections between its neurons. All that we know, all that we are, comes from the way our neurons are connected, says Tim Berners-Lee, inventor of the World Wide Web. A single neuron may possess 10,000 or so dendrites through which it can interact with 10,000 or so other neurons. In total, the brain may contain something like 1,000 trillion connections. The big question is, how does all this mind-bogglingly complex neuronal circuitry allow us to remember things and to learn things? Memory and learning. The common experience of memory is that we remember things that are important to us and forget things that are no longer important to us. Of course, we all forget the occasional important thing, like where we put down a book we were reading or a shopping list scrawled on a scrap of paper. But by and large, we remember and learn things if they are significant to us, that is, connected to things we already know. If you hear a new word in French and you already speak French, you are far more likely to remember it than if you do not speak French. If you know how to balance on a skateboard, you will learn how to balance on a surfboard more easily than someone who has never used a skateboard. In addition to this, repetition seems to be important to remember and learn things. Babies learning to speak repeat the same words over and over. Children learn times tables by reciting them over and over again until they are finally drummed into their skulls. People learning the guitar strum the same sequence of chords hour after hour. None of this, of course, tells us how the brain's neuronal circuitry enables us to remember things and learn new skills. But it does hint that two crucial processes in the brain are making connections with things we already know and repetition. The things we already know are encoded in the pattern of connections between the brain's 100 billion neurons, just as the knowledge of how to contract a muscle to move away from a stimulus in the four-neuron network mentioned earlier was encoded in the connection between the quartet of neurons. Nobody knows exactly how the pattern encodes complex information, although it is perfectly possible to point to a bunch of magnetic memory domains in a computer and say, that is storing a 6 or the letter P. It is not yet possible to point to a bunch of interconnected neurons in the brain and say they are storing the smell of newly baked bread or the knowledge of how to balance on one leg. Nevertheless, all the evidence points to the pattern of connections between neurons being key to what we know. The connections between neurons are made by dendrites. Dendrites are therefore synonymous with what we know. To remember something or learn a new skill, therefore, something must happen to the dendritic connections between neurons. Imagine two neurons that are connected, the axon of the first attached to the dendrite of the second. Now imagine that the first neuron starts firing because it is receiving some stimulus, perhaps some sensory information from the outside world. Remember, the dendritic connection between the two neurons represents something we already know. Now, if the stimulus is repetitive and related to what we know, and the neurotransmitters in the synaptic gap between the axon and the dendrite are primed to amplify the electrical signal if it is related, the dendrite strengthens its connection. This can happen in many ways, but one way is for the dendrite to grow a large number of spines that multiply its connection points. Of course, two neurons connected by a single dendrite can encode only a ridiculously minimal grain of information. However, since all you know is encoded in the totality of dendritic connections in your brain, by strengthening the connections not just between pairs of neurons, but the connections between large numbers of neurons, new knowledge is permanently connected to something you already know, and a memory is laid down. "That is what learning is," wrote novelist Doris Lessing. "You suddenly understand something you've understood all your life, but in a new way." Whenever you read a book or have a conversation, the experience causes physical changes in your brain, says American science writer George Johnson. It is a little frightening to think that every time you walk away from an encounter, your brain has been altered, sometimes permanently. By this process of strengthening connections between neurons, the network that encodes all you know continually changes. But it not only strengthens connections, it makes new connections, and it loses some as well. Think of the neural network of the brain as a vast thicket. In places it is growing, and in other places it is being pruned back, as connections are lost between neurons that share nothing in common. This is the process of you forgetting. What the brain can do that nothing else in the known universe can do is constantly rebuild and rewire itself. The principal activities of brains are making changes in themselves, according to Marvin Minsky. As for learning a new skill, it is a very similar process to laying down a memory. Say, riding a bike requires using certain muscles. Strengthening of the dendrites that connect to neurons that control such muscles makes it easier and faster to control them. Thus, just as a memory is encoded in a network of neurons, a skill such as riding a bike or reading a book is encoded in a network of neurons. It becomes hardwired, automatic. This strengthening and weakening of connections between neurons, or the creation of new connections to modify the network, is known as neuroplasticity. Even for me to concoct this explanation, neuroplasticity had to occur in my brain, and neuroplasticity had to occur in your brain for you to understand my explanation. If you did not understand it, no new permanent connections were made, and I have left your brain just the way it was before. The brain is a computer, but it is a remarkable kind of computer. Whereas a silicon-based computer carries out a task according to the program fed to it by a human being, the brain has no external programmer. It is a self-programming computer. A baby is born with a network of neurons and the potential to connect them in a bewilderingly large number of possible ways. The programming of the baby's brain, the growing of new connections, the strengthening of some connections, and the pruning back of many more, is done by its experience of the world, the information flooding in, hour by hour, day by day, through its eyes, ears, nose, and skin. Although it is very hard to see individual neurons forging links with neighbouring neurons, it is perfectly possible to see the brain programming itself at a much coarser level. The technique of functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, reveals areas of the brain that are working when a person is performing a particular task. For instance, when people have been taught to meditate, it has been possible to see new areas of their brains light up in fMRI scans, new programming. Perhaps one of the most famous examples of fMRI research is a study of London taxi drivers. Eleanor Maguire of University College London showed how a region of the driver's brains that associated with spatial awareness was actually larger than in non-taxi drivers. "The brain is a muscle. Use it or lose it," seems a facile statement, but apart from the small matter of the brain not being a muscle, the "use it or lose it" mantra encapsulates a deep truth about the brain. Just as exercising with weights encourages physiological processes that grow more muscle cells, the processes of remembering things, learning things, and so on, encourages the brain to grow more neuronal connections. And just as not exercising causes muscles to atrophy, not exercising the brain causes it to weaken or lose altogether many of its existing neuronal connections. Even Charles Darwin, who knew nothing of neurons, realized the truth of "use it or lose it."
"If I had to live my life over again, I would have made a rule to read some poetry and listen to some music at least once every week," he wrote in his autobiography, "for perhaps the parts of my brain now atrophied would thus have been kept active through use."
Neuroplasticity is the brain's big secret. Like natural selection in evolution and DNA in genetics, it is an idea so central to understanding the brain that, without it, nothing makes any sense. Neuroplasticity explains how new experiences constantly rewire the brain, the ultimate lump of programmable matter. It explains how the blank slate of a baby's brain becomes an adult brain. It explains how a stroke victim may recover lost faculties when the task of the afflicted neurons is taken over by neurons in an adjacent area of the brain. Rehabilitation is long and hard because the process of reprogramming is analogous to a child learning skills for the first time. And neuroplasticity persists as long as you live. Your brain will still be able to make new connections even when you are 100 years old. A centenarian can learn to use a computer. They might not learn as fast as a child, but they can do it. Can the brain understand the brain?
"The brain boggles the mind," says James Watson, co-discoverer of DNA.
It remains the last and grandest frontier in biology, the most complex thing we have yet discovered in our universe. But we have taken the first tentative steps along the road to understanding it. Nevertheless, there is still a long way to go. But is the destination even reachable?
If the human brain were so simple that we could understand it, we would be so simple that we couldn't,
wrote the American biologist Emerson M. Pugh. Logically, Pugh is correct. The human brain can never completely understand the human brain. It would be like suspending yourself in mid-air by yanking upwards on your shoelaces. However, the brain is not trying to understand the brain. Many brains are trying to understand the brain, the combined minds of international scientific community. All the brains are not in one head, as an Italian proverb puts it. We are still no closer to answering the question posed at the beginning of this chapter. Why is the universe constructed in such a way that it acquires the ability to become curious about itself? But if we understand the brain, we shall finally be able to address it.
As long as our brain is a mystery, said Santiago Ramón y Cajal, the father of neuroscience, the universe, the reflection of the structure of the brain, will also be a mystery.
Chapter 6. The Billion% Advantage. Human Evolution.
Man still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin.
Charles Darwin, The Descent of Man. We are just an advanced breed of monkeys on a minor planet of a very average star. Stephen Hawking, Der Spiegel, 17th of October, 1988. Once upon a time, there was a primitive species of forest-dwelling ape. For some reason, it split into two separate populations. Perhaps it became divided by a mountain range or a treeless corridor. Nobody really knows the truth. However, because the two populations became subject to different survival pressures, they diverged and turned into two distinct species. One species was destined to lead to chimpanzees, the other to human beings. The precise date of the fork in the road between the ancestors of humans and our closest living relatives is not known. But the best bet is that it happened between about 6 and 7 million years ago. This is so recent in evolutionary terms that it explains why we share an astonishing 98% to 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees. Strikingly, however, chimpanzees do not use language, build cities, program computers, or fly to the moon. Somehow, the 1 to 2% genetic difference has been amplified into a 1 billion% advantage in the real world. Understanding how such a minuscule difference in DNA can make such a big difference in practice involves understanding a subtlety of DNA. The popular picture is of a molecule that encodes a series of instructions, or genes, for the building of proteins that determine everything from eye colour to blood group. But there is more to DNA than this. Some genes have the ability to switch on and switch off other genes, controlling the order in which they are read out or expressed in a developing embryo. Although such regulatory genes account for only a small fraction of the 1 to 2% difference between the DNA of humans and chimpanzees, crucially they have a dominant effect on the process of development. Think of regulatory genes as the recipe and standard genes as the ingredients. Similar ingredients, when combined according to different recipes, can create very different dishes. Take eggs. Depending on how they are cooked or not, it is possible to end up with raw eggs, soft-boiled eggs, hard-boiled eggs, pickled eggs, poached eggs, fried eggs, scrambled eggs, an omelette, and so on. In the same way, similar genes, combined according to different molecular recipes, can create animals as radically different as humans and chimpanzees. But regulatory genes show only that it is possible for small differences in DNA to create two species as different as human beings and chimpanzees. They do not tell us how it happened. For that, there is no substitute for the fossil record. Two legs, good. Charles Darwin came up with a possible story of human evolution. Our ancestors, he claimed, first stood up on two legs. This freed their hands to make tools. Making tools required more mental power, which in turn caused their brains to grow. It is an eminently plausible story, except for one thing. It is contradicted by the fossil record. Millions of years before they left any tools, and millions of years before they had big brains, our hominin ancestors in Africa were walking on two legs. Australopithecus anamensis, for instance, was a hominin barely more than a metre high with an ape-sized brain. There is evidence from a fossil shin bone, or tibia, that before 4 million years ago, it was walking on two legs, or bipedal, much of the time. The rest of the time, presumably, it was still hanging around in the trees. Then there is a close relative, Australopithecus afarensis. According to the evidence of a fossil leg bone, it was walking upright by about 3.5 million years ago. But surely one of the most evocative discoveries in all of paleoanthropology was made by Mary Leakey at Laetoli in Tanzania in 1976. Sometime around 3.6 million years ago, three Australopithecines padded on two legs across a bed of freshly fallen volcanic ash. They left their fossilized footprints there for all of posterity. Who does not wonder what these individuals were to each other, whether they held hands or even talked, and what forgotten errand they shared in a Pliocene dawn, says Richard Dawkins. Walking on two legs releases the hands to carry food, or offspring, to fashion tools and to brandish weapons. It also allows an ape to range further afield for food and to spot predators at a greater distance. Darwin was right in believing that bipedalism has distinct advantages. The difficulty is in explaining how it came about. The only changes perpetuated by evolution by natural selection are ones that are immediately advantageous. However, being on two legs requires a major change in the structure of the leg bones. Longer thigh bones and a shorter and wider pelvis, and the development of a powerful bottom muscle, or gluteus maximus, to keep those bones upright and power a running gait. Until both of these changes have been made, which is likely to have taken many generations, there appears to be no survival advantage to being on two legs. One intriguing possibility is that the first steps towards bipedalism were taken not on the ground, but up in the trees. Gibbons and orangutans often saunter on two legs along branches so they can reach the juicier leaves and fruit at the very tips. Our ancestors might have learned this same trick. Then, when they descended to the ground, they continued the walking habit, bounding on two legs between trees. The naked ape. Eventually, something drove our ancestors to stay on the ground permanently, where they perfected their unusual bipedal mode of locomotion. The most likely thing is that the climate gradually became drier. The dwindling rains caused the forest habitat of our hominin ancestors to shrink and be replaced by open grassland, across vast tracts of their African homeland. When other creatures adapted to this new habitat, the lure of the vast grazing herd simply became too great. First cautiously, then with gathering boldness, our ancestors ventured from the leafy shadows out into the unforgiving sun. It was Homo erectus, between about 1.8 and 1.9 million years ago, that made the transition to a recognizably human body shape. Walking upright was an advantage on the exposed grasslands because it minimized the body area presented to the sun. Most likely this was the time when our ancestors lost their fur. Clothed in skin alone, Homo erectus was able to lose heat efficiently by sweating. Actually, we are not quite the naked apes that we at first sight appear. Modern humans actually have as many hairs per square centimetre on their bodies as chimpanzees. However, evolution has made most of this human hair too fine or light to be easily seen. Homo erectus, with its long legs driven by a powerful bottom muscle, perfected bipedalism. Like Bruce Springsteen, it was born to run. Alert for signs such as circling vultures, our ancestors might first have used their long legs to reach carcasses before the scavenging competition could get there. Later, they might have pursued game over great distances, running on and on until the prey was exhausted, a hunting strategy still used by the bushmen of South Africa's Kalahari Desert. Although animals such as antelopes could run much faster than Homo erectus, they could not sustain their running for long. Our relentless marathon-running ancestors simply wore them down. Remarkably, no other predator, not even the wolf, has comparable staying power. Meat is a more concentrated source of energy than plants. When it became a component of the Homo erectus diet, it made possible the growth of the brain, an incredibly energy-hungry organ that monopolizes about 20% of the body's total energy. A chimpanzee on its meager plant diet could not power anything approaching a human-sized brain. Whether or not Homo erectus killed an animal itself or located one that had died in some other way, it would have faced a serious problem at the scene. How to defend the carcass against other carnivores, at least until it could detach enough meat to carry away. The solution might have been to use tools such as rocks or clubs, perhaps even carefully fashioned spears. A million years of boredom. The first evidence of stone tools comes from about 2.6 million years ago, the twilight years of the Australopithecines. This is a puzzle. The received wisdom is that tools allowed our ancestors to butcher meat, making redundant their long canine teeth. With no need for a bulky jaw muscle to power such teeth, it was possible for the skull and brain to grow bigger. However, the fossil evidence does not bear this out. Rather, it shows that the teeth of our ancestors shrank in size long before the advent of tools. In fact, as far back as 4 million years ago, when hominins were already walking upright. One possibility is that tools were used far earlier than 2.6 million years ago, but that they were predominantly made from branches, which were not preserved as fossils. Or they were made from bones, making them indistinguishable from the bones of fossilized skeletons. Such a possibility was envisioned by science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke in the 1960s. In a memorable scene in his 2001 A Space Odyssey, a man-ape, admittedly schooled by an ET artifact, picks up animal bones and, with a wicked gleam in his eyes, realizes he can use them to kill. The first tools were cobbles that had been shattered to expose a cutting edge. Although they appeared about 2.6 million years ago, bizarrely their design remained unchanged for about a million years. Imagine if the design of aeroplanes or computers or houses remained stagnant for 40,000 generations. It was not until about 1.7 million years ago that more sophisticated stone hand axes appeared, with longer, more worked edges than their cobble predecessors. But history then repeated itself. Hand axes remained unchanged for even longer than shattered cobbles, an astonishing 1.4 million years, or almost 60,000 generations. This million years of boredom, twice over, is remarkable when contrasted with the rapid technological changes of the past 10,000 years. One possibility is that the shattered cobble and hand axe worked perfectly well. If it ain't broke, why change it? But just because the tools did not change does not mean that our ancestors did not. Their technological ingenuity might have been used to make tools of wood or bone, which did not survive. Even if this were not the case, our ancestors underwent profound changes. For instance, in their social interactions. Hunting and scavenging and securing prey against big predators undoubtedly required a high degree of cooperation between individuals.
The solitary, isolated human being is really a contradiction in terms, says Archbishop Desmond Tutu. We need other human beings in order to be human.
Just as one bee is no bee, una apus nulla apes, according to the Latin proverb, one human is no human. Within their social groups, males and females, at least during the latter stages of human evolution, were roughly the same in size. Such a similarity is relatively rare among primates, but common among animals that are monogamous. If our ancestors were predominantly monogamous, which seems likely, monogamy might have come about because males fighting over females did not predispose them to cooperate in hunting. In a modern example, the affair of England captain John Terry with the ex-girlfriend of a fellow team member lost him the England captaincy. Winning football games requires cooperation on a football pitch, and the players no longer trusted Terry. Out of Africa. Around about 1.8 million years ago, Homo erectus left the cradle of Africa, spreading to Western Asia and then to Eastern Asia and Southern Europe. Fossil remains have so far been found in China, Java, and Georgia. At this time, a lot of seawater was tied up in ice caps, so Southeast Asia was a much more extensive peninsula than it is today, and no boats were needed to reach places such as Java. The discovery of diminutive hobbit-like skeletons on the Indonesian island of Flores created a sensation in 2003. One possibility is that Homo floresiensis was a descendant of Homo erectus. Another is that it is a descendant of a hominin that left Africa even before Homo erectus. The Homo erectus migration was the first of several known waves of colonization that rippled out from Africa. The migration, like so many events in human history, might have been driven by climate change. The continent of Antarctica had long been iced over, but when North and South America joined up, it was no longer possible for warm tropical water to flow between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. This caused ice to build up at the North Pole, gradually cooling the planet and drying it by sucking moisture from the air. The African grasslands became deserts at times, forcing some African animals to migrate into the Middle East. About 2 million years ago, in particular, two species of saber-toothed cat migrated out of Africa, probably in pursuit of fleeing herds of grazing animals. Our ancestors might not only have followed the herds, but the fearsome predators themselves. Saber-toothed cats abandon their carcasses, and our tool-wielding ancestors would have been the only creatures capable of cracking open the bones and skulls to obtain the energy-rich marrow bone and brains. There might have been a second surge out of Africa about 600,000 years ago. Homo heidelbergensis, named from a fossil jawbone found near Heidelberg in Germany in 1907, was the ancestor of the Neanderthals and modern humans. Then, finally, about 60,000 years ago, modern humans flooded out of Africa and across the world, and eventually, even across space to the moon. It is worth pointing out that although Africa is widely considered the cradle of human evolution, it is quite possible that some of that evolution occurred outside Africa among hominins that then returned to Africa. At present, however, the fossil record is too coarse to reveal such fine detail. Ice Ages. The huge evolutionary changes in hominins are, as far as we know, unprecedented in any animal in the history of life on Earth. They coincided with the repeated advance and retreat of ice from the Earth's polar regions over the past 2 million years. Ice ages are generally caused by cyclical changes in the orientation of the Earth's spin axis and orbit. But what appears to have magnified these Milankovitch cycles, named after Serbian astronomer Milutin Milankovitch, who discovered them, over the past 2 million years, is the rise of the mighty Himalayas, which changed the circulation of the air around the globe. The connecting up of North and South America also closed the tropical channel through which water could be exchanged between the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans, boosting a north-south flow. Living on a planet that repeatedly iced up, hominins were continually subjected to stress by their environment, becoming extinct in cold northern regions and surviving only in regions nearer the equator. But unlike all other creatures on Earth, whose response to advancing ice was merely to migrate to less harsh climes or to go extinct, our human ancestors were unique in having an ability to change their behavior in response to their changing environment. Early on in their history, being adapted for change might not have been enough for them to cope with very rapid climate change. But later on, as their culture became more sophisticated, they adapted caves as shelters from the cold, fashioned clothing out of animal skins, and harnessed fire. Fire. Nobody knows when and how fire was first tamed. There is disputed evidence from South Africa that it happened as long ago as 1 million years, but good evidence exists only as far back as a few hundred thousand years. Probably the first fire to be used by humans was a natural fire. Someone, on a bitterly cold night, carried a smouldering branch, ignited perhaps by lightning, into the mouth of a freezing cave. Only much later did people learn how to make fire. This is a difficult skill that, even today, very few people possess. It is possible that the secret of making fire was discovered and lost repeatedly whenever someone who knew the secret died. This might throw some light on why technological progress, such as improvements in tools, was so slow for enormously long periods of time before there were explosions of creativity. As long as our ancestors lived in small, scattered groups, knowledge might have been gained, lost, gained and lost again repeatedly. Only when hominin numbers swelled sufficiently was there a chance of ideas surviving, spreading, and spawning new ideas. Fire made possible cooking, arguably one of the most important developments in human history. Cooking detoxified some plant poisons, boosting the range of plants that could be eaten safely, and it killed parasites in meat. But most importantly, cooking broke down the proteins in meat so that they were easier to digest, doing some of the work of the gut. Just as a tool is an enhancement of a limb, a cooking pot is an enhancement of the stomach. More than that, it is an external stomach. It means that the stomach can be smaller and less energy hungry, and this frees up yet more energy for the insatiable needs of an ever-growing brain. Since Homo erectus had small teeth and small jaws, it is possible that as early as 1.5 million years ago, it was cooking its food. The first strong evidence of cooking, however, is from Neanderthals and early modern humans about 200,000 years ago. Neanderthals. In the icy world, our direct ancestors came up against many of their hominin cousins. It is striking that none of them has survived. Most intriguing is the case of the Neanderthals, descendants of an earlier wave of colonization of the world. Being shorter and wider-bodied than modern humans, they were built for the cold. They made tools, buried their dead, and for a long time appeared to be thriving. They probably had language, which is believed to have originated at least 500,000 years ago. However, their vocal regions indicate that they might have uttered a smaller range of sounds than humans, and that the sounds might have been higher pitched. Ultimately, however, Neanderthals died out, their last known outposts being caves on the southern coast of the Iberian Peninsula. There has long been a suspicion that Neanderthals were wiped out by modern humans. The truth, however, might be more subtle. For instance, about 2.5% of the DNA of modern humans living outside Africa is believed to be Neanderthal, indicating that there was interbreeding between the two species. It might be that our ancestors had a small 1-2% competitive advantage over their cousins. Magnified over many, many generations, this could have seen them monopolize ever more territory and game. One such advantage that humans had over Neanderthals was sewing. Human needles are found from about 40,000 years ago, but no Neanderthal needle has ever been found. Being able to sew enabled our ancestors to make better clothes. Better baby clothes might have ensured that in a bitter cold snap, human newborns had a slightly higher chance of surviving than Neanderthal neonates. It could have been just enough to see humans prosper at the expense of Neanderthals. By about 50,000 years ago, Homo sapiens was king. Probably no hominin species had ever amounted to more than about 10,000 to 100,000 individuals, at the most a million. But by 2012, Homo sapiens had expanded to 7 billion individuals, filling every niche on the globe and threatening the survival of every other species on Earth. The future for humans. Some biologists argue that evolution has now stopped for human beings. We have adapted our environment to us and no longer need to adapt to it. But this ignores the fact that most people, apart from those in the affluent Western world, face a daily battle for survival as challenging as that faced by their ancient hominin ancestors. Even in the West, the demands of an ever more complex and connected world must be having a profound effect on the wiring of our brains. Science fiction writers have often envisioned humans of the far future as having big brains and stick-like atrophied legs, but this is to ignore the lesson of fossil history. Cro-Magnons, our ancestors in Europe, had bodies and brains between 5% and 10% bigger than ours. The reason for this might have been that a bigger body was a stronger body, able to protect itself and ensure survival. And every second of every day, Cro-Magnons had to worry about survival. Whereas today, many of us live in a more benign world where someone else does the hunting. Someone else supplies the food. Tellingly, domesticated animals invariably have smaller brains than their wild cousins. Through culture, humans effectively domesticated themselves, said paleoanthropologist Louis Leakey. Whatever the reason for the rapid shrinking of people after Cro-Magnons, the trend is clear. Contrary to expectations, the humans of the future will probably have brains that are not bigger than ours, but significantly smaller. Of course, whether we actually have a future depends on our solving a multitude of global problems, many of our own making. It is here that we confront the sobering lesson of our past, for as the American biologist Edward O. Wilson said, "We have created a Star Wars civilization, but we have Stone Age emotions." Part 2. Putting Matter to Work. Chapter 7. A Long History of Genetic Engineering.
The first human who hurled an insult instead of a stone was the founder of civilization, Sigmund Freud. Culture is roughly everything we do and monkeys don't,
Fitzroy Somerset, 4th Baron Raglan. The human story did not, of course, finish with the Ice Ages. The ice spread down from the poles, the ice returned whence it came. Over and over again, ebbing and flowing like a mile-deep white tide. But then, after the ice had retreated and the sea level had risen for the umpteenth time, something changed in the world. The change was so profound that the train of events it set in motion could conceivably prevent the return of the ice, not for a while, but forever. The development was, of course, farming. For thousands of generations, humans had no choice but to eat what produce nature laid out on its table. As hunters, they had followed the great herds of game. As gatherers, they had picked fruit and berries from bushes and trees. But around 8,500 BC, in the southwest corner of Asia, there appeared something entirely new under the sun. A fresh and innovative way of living. The Fertile Crescent is a band of biological abundance whose epicenter is the land between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in present-day Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Among the plants that thrived there were wild grasses with big edible seeds. No doubt people had grazed on these cereals for as long as they had grazed on other berries and fruit. In fact, since the plants often grew in large stands, people might have begun to rely on them for a significant part of their diet. Around 12,000 BC, the world was still in the grip of intense cold, but the Ice Age was beginning to falter, and its last millennium was punctuated by spells when the climate warmed just a little. During one of these spells, according to British archaeologist Chris Scar, people began to do something they had never done before. The details are sketchy. Perhaps they uprooted cereals and replanted them in moist, rich soil close to one of the big rivers, or maybe they simply weeded out competing plants in order to leave a field that was exclusively covered in cereals. In the beginning, the cereals selected for special treatment were indistinguishable from their wild versions, but something subtle that people did began to change everything. They planted only the wild cereals with the biggest seeds and the easiest to remove husks. And when they harvested their cereals, they replanted only the cereals that had borne the biggest seeds and whose husks popped open most readily. Gradually, because of these actions, the seeds grew bigger and easier to harvest season by season. Inadvertently, without the slightest idea of what they were doing to the DNA of their crops, the farmers of the Fertile Crescent had become the first genetic engineers, exponents of evolution by human or artificial selection. Natural selection was not completely cut out of the equation. The plants that thrived were precisely those that could best tolerate the artificial environments created by humans. Plants that grew fast even when exposed to the baking sun in unshaded fields, or which grew strong when packed close together in rows. But whether it was natural selection that was operating or human selection, it was operating to a human agenda. For the first time in history, people were directing the evolution of other species. By 8,500 BC, the cereals had diverged so significantly from their wild cousins that they were a different species. Wheat had become domesticated, and it was not alone. By 8,500 BC, people had domesticated pea and olive too, and these were just the first of many domesticated crops that would follow over succeeding millennia. Modern agriculture had begun, and nothing in the world of humans, nothing in the world would be the same again. An obvious question is, why did farming start in the present interglacial and not in the previous one, between 130,000 and 115,000 years ago? A possible answer is that humans at the time had not yet evolved the intellectual capacities and imagination of fully modern humans. The sudden flowering of art across the world around 50,000 BC is often taken as evidence of a profound change in the wiring of human minds. Communities, chiefs, and cuneiform. The changes brought about by the shift to growing food were profound. For the first time in history, people were able to live their whole lives in one location. Instead of brief overnight halts around campfires, they were able to stop for good in permanent settlements. That is not to say that there had been no settlements before. People might have been able to stay put if, for instance, they were close to an abundant source of food, such as a fish-filled lake. Farming, however, made it possible for a lifestyle that had been a rare exception to become widespread. But the key change was not the creation of settlements, but the creation of a food surplus. Farming can typically feed between 10 and 100 times as many people per square kilometre as hunting and gathering. The surplus of food meant more people could be supported, which meant the population could grow. Ironically, this growth inevitably meant that the food was spread ever more thinly, so in the long term, people might actually have been more badly nourished than their hunter-gatherer ancestors. But by this time, there were too many people per square kilometre to be supported by the old lifestyle. The point of no return had been passed, and there was no going back. The surplus of food meant not only that more people could be fed, it meant that not everyone needed to be engaged in obtaining food. For the first time, it was possible to support non-productive people, such as craftsmen who made bricks or pottery or jewellery. Of course, craftsmen could not exist without a market for their goods, and here the new developments fed off each other. The sedentary lifestyles permitted people to clutter their homes with belongings. By contrast, hunter-gatherers continually on the move were limited to what they could carry, a baby or a handful of spears. But the food surplus, in addition to supporting craftsmen, could also support soldiers whose job was to defend a settlement and its fields. And not only soldiers, but a chief. Hunter-gatherer societies tend to be egalitarian. However, settlements of many people are complex. And just as the myriad functions of a cell need to be orchestrated by a central nucleus, the myriad functions of a village need to be orchestrated by some kind of central government. The control of people by such a ruling elite, with soldiers at its disposal, provided both dangers and opportunities. Inevitably, it would lead to conflicts over land and resources, but it would also spawn cities, and eventually empires of hundreds of thousands, even millions of souls. Such vast accumulations of people were an extraordinary and unprecedented thing. Our great ape cousins live in small bands and react violently to outsiders. Initially, humans might have shared their xenophobia. But as communities grew in size, people had to overcome their knee-jerk instinct to lash out at others. Benjamin Franklin spelled out the recipe for living in large communities. Be civil to all, sociable to many, familiar with few. The key importance of this was recognized by Sigmund Freud. It is impossible to overlook the extent to which civilization is built up upon a renunciation of instinct, he wrote. Natural selection was probably operating here too. Those settlements where people were best at living in close proximity to each other without running amok had the lowest death rates and so grew faster than others. Their numerical domination meant that over time people became ever more passive and tolerant of each other. This is the view of Canadian-born psychologist Steven Pinker, who argues that despite millions dying in the world wars of the 20th century, the human race has shown a marked trend towards becoming less violent and warlike.
Civilization is just a slow process of learning to be kind, wrote Tennessee Williams.
People might have actually gone so far along the road to getting on with each other that they now choose to flock together in cities where they can interact with many others. People like being with other people, says Scar. Charles Dickens, who found himself living at a unique time when 19th century London was making the transition to a megacity of many millions, was one of the first to notice the new opportunities for interactions between large numbers of people. It might explain why in his novels chance encounters play such a big role. The growth of societies and the growth of their complexity eventually triggered another profound development in human history, the invention of writing. This did not happen overnight. At first, the wedge-shaped marks made on clay tablets by the Sumerians around 3400 BC recorded only dull commercial transactions. But basic cuneiform was superseded by written languages that could express non-utilitarian things such as thoughts and feelings. Just as the cooking pot acted as an external stomach, the written word acted as an external memory. Whereas only a small amount of knowledge could be transmitted between people verbally, an enormous amount could be now transmitted in written form. By means of writing, the human race acquired a collective brain. Its full awakening would require widespread literacy, which would take many millennia. But even in the earliest days, the writing was on the wall. Pun intended. Animal magic. So far, I have not mentioned animals. But of course, the first genetic engineers did not simply manipulate plants. They captured and tamed large mammals and bred them for passivity or meat content. In the process, animals too diverged from their wild cousins and became domesticated. Not only did they provide food, but they provided the motive power to pull ploughs, to break up the hard soil, and to pull goods on wheeled carts. The first animals to be domesticated, again in the Fertile Crescent, were sheep and goats around 8000 BC. In China, pigs and silkworms were both domesticated by 7500 BC, along with rice and millet. The importance of animals to humans cannot be overestimated. Everywhere in the world where there are people, animals live with them, not just as walking larders, but also as pets. The American anthropologist Pat Shipman argues that our relationship with animals is central to understanding the extraordinary success of humans. She points out that from the moment humans first became artists, around 50,000 BC, they rarely depicted themselves or their environment. Instead, almost exclusively, they painted prey animals. Their stunningly vivid representations, perfect in every anatomical detail, reveal what fantastically keen observers of animal behaviour they were. And it was this intense studying of animals, Shipman argues, that enabled humans to outthink their prey. It is the key, she believes, to understanding how a puny and insignificant ape, outrun and outgunned by big predators on the African savannah, managed to gain such control over its world. Controversially, Shipman even believes that language might have arisen in order to exchange knowledge about animals. She believes this explains why humans domesticated an animal such as the dog, which is rarely eaten and which actually competes for the very same food resources with humans. Dogs were domesticated at least 17,000 years ago, and possibly as early as 32,000 years ago. The fact we keep pets, Shipman believes, reveals a profound important truth. Without animals, humans are not humans. Together, the domestication of plants and animals can be categorized as the invention of food production. This was the post-Ice Age revolution that transformed the human race. Everything that has happened since has been a consequence of it. The birth of a sedentary lifestyle, first in villages, then in cities. The birth of specialized jobs. the creation of ruling elites, the birth of writing, the invention of war and creation of empires. In 8500 BC, a ball was set rolling that was unstoppable and that to this day is continuing to gather momentum. Modern milestones. There have been so many milestones along the road to the world of the 21st century that it is hard to know what to mention and what to leave out. But some of the most important developments occurred from the late 15th century onwards. Very significant was the advent of ships that could cross oceans, connecting Europe to the Americas, Africa, Asia, and finally Australia. This marked the beginning of a truly global civilization. Later, towards the end of the 18th century, world trade was boosted enormously by mechanized factories that could mass-produce goods. This industrial revolution was powered first by water, then by coal, an energy source around 150 times more potent than human muscle power. Having access to such energy sources is one of the reasons that only a few percent of the population are able to provide food for the overwhelming majority. A development just before the Industrial Revolution, however, was also hugely significant. The rise of science in the 17th century illustrates how the collisions between ideas or technologies can spawn new ideas and new technologies. For thousands of years, there had been craftsmen. By getting their hands dirty, they discovered how to make harder swords or better clay pots, but they worked by trial and error and never created a theory of what they were doing to guide them in finding ways to do it better. Besides the craftsmen, there were natural philosophers. Beginning with the Greeks,